Hey, everybody. Welcome back to King of the Ride podcast. I'm your host. I am Ted King. I'm excited to have you today. And I'm very excited for this podcast. Our guest today is Michael Vandenham. Michael is a staple to the North American cyclocross circuit. He's a four-time Canadian national champion. He's tallied six UCI cyclocross race wins. He's raced the world championships at very impressive seven different occasions. And in saying that, I realized perhaps it's my biggest oversight of this interview by not having asked him about the time he was involved in a bit of a tumble in the 2023 Cyclocross World Championships, and he was seen by millions of people around the world when he snapped his finger back into place, having dislocated it. Cyclocross racers are tough. But we're not here to talk about crashes. We still have a very fun time today talking about all things two wheels. So I bring him onto the show because he has a lengthy list of palmares. He's someone with whom I bumped shoulders with many times over the years in gravel races, but he's only dipped his toe into it up until this point. He has recently announced his retirement from the professional cyclocross circuit, having raced a near decade and a half. And naturally, gravel is a handy next step, and he was right there in the mix at the recent Mid-South gravel race just a few weeks ago. Michael has plenty on his plate as the new team coach for Canada on the cyclocross side. He has a one-year-old at home and a newfound discipline to train for in the form of gravel, so I'm thrilled to have one of the nicest guys and newest faces and fiercest competitors on the gravel circuit here on the show. Hey, here's a quick note. Taking care of your health is often thought of as very complex, but it should also be very simple, and that's why for the last 2 years I've been drinking AG1 every day, no exceptions. It's one scoop into water, and starting my day with AG1 gives me a jump start to the day. I feel immediately energized, hydrated, and I'm ready to roll. And that's because AG1 delivers my daily dose of vitamins, minerals, pre and probiotics, and much, much more. So the one product I want to recommend to elevate your health, it is AG1, and that's why I've partnered with them for so long. If you want to take ownership of your health, start with AG1. Try it and get a free one-year supply of vitamin D3 and K2. And five free AG1 travel packs with your first purchase just by visiting drinkag1.com/Ted King. Again, that's drinkag1.com/Ted King. Check it out. Folks, next up, Michael Vandenham. Michael Vandenham, I am excited to have you on the podcast. You are not our first Canadian, but there are not a lot of Canadians that have been on the show. And I wanted to start with a little bit of trivia. Now, first, you can confirm that you were raised in Manitoba. Is that right?
That's true, yep.
Okay, good, because that's where I've derived most of my trivia. Actually, all of my trivia. So, to our United States audience, Manitoba is north of North Dakota. So I'm sort of picturing that, like kind of flat, and yeah, a lot of space.
Super, super similar. And I would say like similar culture, similar economy. It's largely based on farming.
Okay.
Similar people in the sense that like our license plates say friendly Manitoba on them. That's kind of Manitoba shtick.
Okay. I like that. That's better than saying north of North Dakota. So, okay, ready. First, do you know, this is low-hanging fruit, what is the nickname of your province, Manitoba?
We call it Manisnoba sometimes. I don't know which one. I don't know if there's another one.
The one I'm going for is the Keystone Province. Have you heard that?
Oh, yeah, of course. Absolutely. It kind of looks, so the reason that is that the whole province kind of looks like a keystone, I guess, what you put a key inside of.
See, that makes a lot of sense. This is the follow-up answer that I saw to the question of why is it called the Keystone Province? Because it's the vital transportation hub in Canada and home to over blank number of lakes, which is part of the next question, offering plenty of outdoor activities and beautiful landscapes for nature enthusiasts.
Did you get that off of like Tourism Manitoba or something?
If you Google Manitoba trivia, there's so many websites. It's amazing. Okay.
That sounds like something the tourism board put up.
Oh, completely. Sure. The best part is it's like the same person was hired to collect these facts, because when I was trying to go to different sites and collect new pieces of trivia, they were all giving me the same thing. Okay. So Minnesota, also near that North Dakota, Manitoba area. Down here, that's the land of, they call it the land of 10,000 lakes, which is a little bit inaccurate because there are actually 11,842. Do you know how many lakes are in Manitoba?
Oh my goodness. No, a lot. We had a boat growing up and there was like five or six lakes within 20-minute drive that you could go to. Uh-huh. I'm going to say, because we have to be better than Minnesota, I'm going to say 20,000.
There are more than 100,000 lakes.
I should have, that was in my head. I was like, I think it's 100,000 lakes. And I was like, that's too many lakes. It can't be right.
It's unreal. Like, we're so boastful of our 10,000 lakes here in Minnesota. And that's nothing. 10,000 versus 100,000, that's insane.
Manitoba, 10 times better than Minnesota.
There you go. That's a good license plate. Okay. This one's a little bit out there, but it segues to the next one quite well. Which fictional childhood storybook character was born in Manitoba?
Oh, boy.
And admittedly, it's hard to have somebody or something born in a place that is fictional.
Fictional childhood character.
Yep.
I've got nothing for you. Well, which one?
The answer is, I'll give you a hint, but I can't. Well, okay, here's my hint. The hint is it's a bear.
Oh, Winnie the Pooh.
Nailed it.
Of course. Okay. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. I should have got that right off the bat. That's like Manitoba folklore right there.
Okay, it's pretty great.
I was thinking humans. I missed the whole animal side of things.
Well, yeah, it's sort of a long drawn out question. The follow-up is the beloved children's character, Winnie the Pooh, is inspired by a real bear named Winnipeg who lived at the London Zoo. Winnie the Pooh's creator, A.A. Milne, named the character after the endearing bear. Okay. So, I bring that one up because we're on the topic of bears. True or false, the world's largest population of polar bears is in Manitoba.
Yeah, it's got to be in Churchill, I think, if you're looking at the closest major. Well, majors may be not that major. Closest population, large population area would be Churchill for sure.
You're crushing it. That is correct. The town of Churchill, located on the shores of Hudson Bay, is renowned as the polar bear capital of the world. It offers unique opportunities to observe these majestic creatures in their natural habitat.
I've not been up there. It's quite hard to get to Churchill, believe it or not.
Yeah.
I mean,
it's bananas. I did this bike ride along the James Bay in February with a couple of your fellow countrymen. And that was scary for any number of reasons because it was really dangerous. And the first day we were in polar bear country. And so thankfully we left polar bear country and we survived both the elements and the polar bears. But then that same crew, minus me, then did, I forget exactly what the title is, but they did the longest fill in the blank in Canada, like the longest winter road fat bike ride, which included riding through Churchill. And the number of polar bears they saw was insane, which is just also insane.
I don't think I'd want to see a polar bear while riding a fat bike.
I don't
disagree. None of that sounds good to me.
I don't disagree at all. There's an amazing story about that I can tell you offline. But yeah, do you know Buck Miller?
No, I don't. I'll say, who are you riding with?
Eric Batty, Buck Miller, and Ryan Atkins. We rode this James Bay descent, and then every year they go back and do just some ridiculous thing. They cross the Algonquin on skis. The Churchill one, I got to get the details because when you tell a story without key details like these, it's a really terrible story. But they show at the end of one of their rafting trips that Buck did, they were picked up by a helicopter, might have been by a float plane, and they were just surrounded by polar bears.
Oh.
It was eerie. I mean, yeah, that's like hanging out with sharks. Anyway, okay, last question. Not related to bears at all. Do you know the first million-dollar hockey player? Are you a hockey fan at all?
I am a hockey fan, yeah.
Okay.
Not a Winnipeg Jets fan, unfortunately.
Yep.
Only because they didn't exist when I was growing up. There was like a little hiatus. I think the Jets moved out in 93 or something like that, and then they didn't come back until I was already in university.
Yeah. So, okay, well, let me go off topic. This is not a trivia question. Who was your team growing up?
I was and still am a Leafs fan, which is a little embarrassing because the Leafs are like, you know, it's the Yankees. It's cheering for the New England Patriots. But you pick these teams as a kid and you're just attached to them. I'm a Leafs fan. Always will be.
Great choice. They're a good team to hate. I've always liked their jerseys. I like their logo. I liked Grant Fuhr growing up. Felix Potvin. He was the goalie when I was
there. We go. Yeah, the cat.
Yeah.
Yeah. And then they also had Curtis Joseph, who also had a cat on his mask. They had some good. And then they had Eddie the Eagle Belfour.
Yes.
Good assortment of goalies for a while there.
Bingo. So, okay. This certainly precedes your time. Who was the first million-dollar hockey player who played for the Jets in 1972?
Who played for the Jets in 72?
I'm really putting you on the spot because if somebody asked me this question, I'd be like, I have literally no idea. I'll give you a hint.
Was it Gordie Howe?
Nope. Although that would be a good guess because my hint was going to be this player had a son who also was a perennial all-star. His son played for the St. Louis Blues.
Bobby Hall.
Bing, 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 ding, ding, ding. Man,
yeah, I was trying to think. I was like, wait, did Gordie Howe play for the Jets? I know one of them did when they were in the WHA.
Yeah.
But I think it was Bobby Hall.
Oh, this is amazing. Well, okay. You have certainly surpassed any expectation of doing well. I think you nailed every question. Congratulations.
Kind of.
And I appreciate you playing. That is all. Bye-bye. Just kidding. I'm thrilled to talk to you. I'm a New Englander, right? And New England and cyclocross go hand in hand, even though I only raced a few cyclocross races. You are, if someone were to read your palmares, they predominantly exist on the cyclocross side of things. So it's an interesting contrast now to have you on this show and to talk to you because I'm congratulating you on your retirement from cyclocross, which just took place a few months ago. And in the same sentence, I'm congratulating you on doing really well at Mid-South, which is one of America's biggest gravel races, just, 2 weeks ago. So, congratulations all around.
Well, thank you. It's kind of a funny, just today, actually, on Instagram, someone called me a gravel racer. And I was like, wait, oh yeah, I guess I am that now. Previous to this, I identified as a cross racer who maybe dabbled in gravel in the summer.
That's exactly kind of it. How did you feel about that titling?
It's in my Instagram handle for crying out loud. I think I still think I'm a cross racer, but you're right. I sort of hung up my tubulars or whatever in November, for lots of different reasons. One of them being I have a 1 year old now, and cross is an incredibly travel intensive discipline, right? You're basically racing two times a weekend all over the place. And the other one being that it's also kind of a bit of a young man's sport in a lot of ways, with just how short and explosive the races are. It felt like every year I was having a harder and harder time keeping up and a harder and harder time, like, getting to the level that I wanted to be at, just in terms of losing positions off the start and losing positions out of corners. And it's like, at a certain point you go, you know what? I think maybe I should move to what my physiology and my age is pushing me towards.
what is your age? Remind me.
I'm 31.
That's what I was going to guess.
So I guess that's what, middle-aged in cycling terms?
Yeah, something like that. So
I'm old. I don't know.
Do you think
somewhere in there?
Do you think that really is a physiology thing? Like, I mean, you're such a great case example of it. To lose explosivity is something that just happens physiologically.
Yeah, that's good. So I think if I look at myself as a rider, I was never the most snappy, punchy person, even when I was, you know, even when I was 22, 23 as a cross racer. I always excelled in heavy, sloggy, hilly, whatever type of courses. But I do think that it got harder and harder to sort of be able to maintain that. And that could be a variety of factors. If I look at the power data, it wasn't like I was losing much off of my 15 or 30 second. Maybe the sport you know, sports progress
all
the time.
Yeah.
It just gets better. It gets younger. It gets faster. We see this across lots of different disciplines. So there might be an element of that as well. But there was definitely a little bit where I naturally tended to be good at these longer 20 plus minute efforts.
Uh-huh.
And I was always, the training I was doing for cross was always counteracting that a little bit. It was like, okay, what can we do to get snappier? My coach is a guy named Al Donahue with Cycle Smart and has been for years. Good New England folk there.
Dude, Al and I were teammates in about 2003.
Ah, amazing. So we were always doing different types of testing, trying to figure out like, okay, how can I get snappier? What efforts, like, you know, I could never touch threshold type work out of fear that it would sort of dull my top end. So it's been super interesting now going towards gravel. And it's like, we're leaning into that and maybe it's already paying off in some respects, right?
Wait, say that again. You didn't want to touch threshold at the risk of losing top end.
Yeah. There's kind of the theory there. The training idea is you can sort of dull a lot of your explosiveness and a lot of your snappiness by doing a ton of work right around threshold. This sort of falls in line if you're into like training philosophies with the polarized training model.
Yeah.
So, you know, polarized model is you spend 80% of your time sort of in the, you know, it'd be called zone one, I guess, but endurance and below, and then you spend 20% of your workouts above threshold, and you basically don't go into that middle zone at all.
Yep.
And that works really well for athletes doing shorter duration disciplines like cross, mountain biking, even a lot of road racing. And the reason you do that is because kind of the theory is that you spend too much time in that middle zone. And while you get good, you know, you might actually boost your threshold numbers, you're doing it at the sacrifice of some of that top end. And a lot of the races now, cross, mountain bike, whatever, are not decided just by threshold. They're decided, well, can you do that minute long attack, and or can you repeat that 30-second effort over and over and over again? And that's very much cross.
Yep. Interesting. Well, yeah, I guess I was trying to decide what you meant top end. Do you mean like tip top end or like VO2 or I hear
like VO2 and above. Yeah. So we, you know, going into doing more gravel, we've totally switched up my training where I actually hadn't done 20 minute efforts in like 7 or 8 years. Right.
Sure.
And we're actually doing those now.
Yeah. Yeah. They're kind of miserable. I'm doing a ton of it too. So to speak to something you said a minute ago about the sports are changing and maybe cyclocross was changing over your time. My goodness. So the last time I saw you was 2 weeks ago at Mid-South. My average power to get whatever, I think I got 14th, was 30 watts higher. My normalized was 40 watts higher. My time was 35 minutes faster than 5 years ago where I sprinted for second.
Yeah. Yeah. We might have been looking at this similar year because I compared
my
numbers.
It the year before.
I did it. Let's see. I've done it 4 times, I think. I did it 2 years ago. I think I know the year you're talking about, actually. I did like 4 or 5 years ago, just before the pandemic. And then I did it in 2018 as well.
Crazy. What brings you to that event in particular as someone who's not yet fully immersed in calling themselves a gravel racer?
You know what? In 2018, the reason I went there is I was running a cross team with a guy named Dylan Postier who lived in Stillwater.
No kidding.
So it was just kind of a coincidence. And he was like, hey, we have this event and it gets, I think 2018 was probably, I'm going to be wrong here, but it was probably one of the first years that it sold out. Like one of the first years that it was getting to be a really big event.
Uh-huh.
And he was like, hey, you should come out. I think it'd be good for the team. We have local sponsors. But to highlight the difference between then and now is I raced Cross Worlds that year. I probably took 3 weeks off the bike. I got on the bike for 2 weeks and then I got second.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it's like, there's not a chance. There's no way you could do that now. The level is so, so much higher. But I was even, to your point, I was even looking at the numbers from 2 years ago where I got blown out of the lead group or something with 30K left. And I was, 40 watts higher normalized this year, which is just crazy to think about.
It is. I mean, it speaks to, I think we're at the point that if you win a single race for the folks at the very front of the group, you can put that on your race resume and go to sponsors and say, this was a great year because I won a race. I won Mid-South. And yeah, I mean, it's no different than the World Tour or any other big race, cyclocross. If you say you won a single big race of the year, that makes your whole season.
Yeah, it really does. And the people, I had to stop doing this because it was getting kind of intimidating given how little I had trained at the beginning of this year. But I was looking at the amount Strava stalking people and seeing how much, you know, Payson and Toby and yourself were riding.
Dude, I've been riding a ton.
This is bad. I was like, I have ridden half as much as some people.
Well, you're doing quality or something because you did have a very good race.
Thank you.
All right. I want to keep talking about bikes, but let's go way back because I need to bring the Manitoba piece back in. So if your Wikipedia page is right, you were born in Nova Scotia.
That is 100% incorrect.
For real?
Really? I should go in and edit my Wikipedia page. I like that it thinks I was born in Nova Scotia.
Yeah.
You know who was, I think, born in Nova Scotia was Lesby, but not me.
Well, yeah, but I wasn't on his website.
Yeah, but maybe people are just like, Canadian. Must be born in Nova Scotia.
This is hilarious. I apologize to our listener as I'm doing this live. Yeah, born. Are you born on August 2nd?
Yeah, that's right.
Halifax, Nova Scotia.
I think I've only been to Halifax once. That's really funny. No, I was born in Brandon, Manitoba, and then I lived there until I went to school at 18.
Okay. So, yeah, how does someone, I believe you grew up on a farm. How does someone, regardless, farm or not, well, actually, farm is important if that's true. How'd you grow up on a farm in Manitoba and eventually make your way into the career of a professional cyclist?
Yeah, good question. And I think I never thought much of it as I was getting more into cycling. But looking back, I sort of see that as like a series of really improbable events that led me into cycling. Because like you said, you would never think of a farm kid from Manitoba. I grew up, you know, there was a couple bike shops in town. There might have been a mountain bike race, but it certainly wasn't like a hotbed of cycling culture or anything like that. So there's a couple parts to that story. Is I grew up as a kid who played a lot of sports. I played hockey, volleyball, soccer. None of them terribly well, if I'm being really honest. And I also grew up as like a bit of a little chubby kid. Not because I wasn't active, it just was what it was. So At some point, I guess I got sick of being a chubby kid and I decided that I was going to like, you know, I had always liked riding my bike. I liked riding my bike to school, which was maybe 10 or 15 kilometers. I had enjoyed the process of like accomplishing something. And I just kind of got into running every morning around high school. And that sort of dovetailed into getting into riding my bike through the summer. And the process of setting goals and trying to accomplish them, I think just sort of, it just like meshed with me. I really enjoyed it.
Yep.
So that one summer I set a goal of riding, you know, 1,000 kilometers. And the next summer I was like, oh, I'm going to ride 2,000 kilometers.
That's awesome.
But all this was happening. And I think I was only vaguely aware that bike racing was something you could do. I had a brother who had gone away to university and was living in Ottawa and racing bikes. So I would talk to him about it, but it was really far removed from what I saw day to day.
Yeah.
So at some point I started working at the bike shop and, I think I did an MS ride was the very first organized event I did at 16. And I was like riding a borrowed time trial bike, wearing baggy shorts. Cause I was, you know, I didn't want to wear spandex. So that was like kind of embarrassing.
Yeah.
And I was just like, it's not a race, but I was like in the lead group with all these people who are cyclists. And one of them after the event took me aside and went like, do you do this? Have you done this before? And I went, no. And he reached out to the provincial cycling coach who lived in Winnipeg and was basically went, hey, there's this kid, this farm kid from Manitoba. And he just rides his bike really hard and seems to be pretty good at it. Like you should reach out to him.
Nice.
And I guess that kind of started all these like little improbable steps of coach reached out to me. I started doing some races. I started getting a little bit into mountain biking. I, you know, went away to university and realized that there was a strong local cyclocross scene there, realized that was something you could do.
Yeah.
And it's just like, yeah, all these little things kind of got to the point where I finally at 21, 22 was kind of immersed in the cycling scene, but it certainly took a lot longer than, you know, a lot of kids who get into bikes have parents who are really avid cyclists or something like that. And they're just exposed to it right away. Mine was very incremental.
Yeah. Yeah. I can't imagine there's much time to be lazy on a farm. And also, I guess, depending on how much your parents are relying on you to do stuff, there's also not a ton of time to ride. What is the farm setting? Presumably your parents were receptive to the idea of letting you ride. What was home life like?
Yeah, absolutely. My parents were very, very supportive without really having any idea of what cycling was, right? Mm-hmm. So I did spend a lot of time working on the farm. Typically we were on a grain farm, so that meant the busy season for me anyways was harvest in August and September. And I would typically work on the farm, but kind of right off the bat, I probably started doing that when I was 16. I guess my dad or my parents allowed me to make time for it. And I also made time to ride a couple hours in the morning just as something to do. And then typically the way harvest works is you have to wait for the dew to sort of dry off the crop. So then you kind of get to work around 11 or 12 and work till 10 or 11 at night, basically until the dew falls again.
Yeah.
And then kind of do that on repeat. But typically I would have a couple hours in the morning where I could go and ride my bike or do whatever. And even at that point, even though I wasn't really training, I didn't have a coach or anything like that. I just, like I said, I think the process of being an endurance athlete and getting out and doing something and having an objective just sort of resonated with me right off the bat.
Yep.
And it didn't take a coach to feel like I wanted to do that. It didn't take races to feel like I wanted to do that. It just was like I felt better when I was out riding my bike, and I felt better, you know, I felt good when I finished the ride, and that was just like, it's just important.
Yeah. Yeah. It's an interesting thing. I have some friends who have kids a couple years older than ours. Like our oldest is 4. And so the concept of endurance sports doesn't even exist. But then for my friends' kids who are now at the age where like cross country running is a thing, it's funny to instill the idea of suffering to a 10-year-old, be like, you need to run harder than the other person to make it suck. And I mean, we talked about Nielsen a minute ago, and he talked about his parents creating a lot of games for track practice and so on and so forth. But
I do sort of think like there's definitely something to that, but I do sort of think that endurance athletes figure out that they're endurance athletes, right?
Yeah.
It's like there's something there where, yes, your parents instill this idea of working hard in whatever you're doing. And that was definitely a part of my upbringing, whether it be soccer or hockey or just like day to day. And they modeled that too, which I think is just as important as teaching it. Mm-hmm. But there was also something where it's like, you start running and for me, it just clicked. It's like, well, I want to go further the next day. Well, yeah. I want to go faster the next day. Like, can I do more? Can I do more? And that, I don't know, maybe that was learned, but it also just felt like it was something that just clicked. Like, that's the way I was wired. It's what I wanted to do.
Yeah. Yeah. I do think there's a huge innate aspect of that where it's just, it's in you or not. And there's probably a commonality among a lot of endurance athletes. How about the next phase? I mean, I come from the background of road racing. So the aspiration along the way is to make a team, right? And land on a team. And all of a sudden, all of your cares are taken care of, which I say sort of as in jest, but in truth, because the logistics are taken care of and sponsorship is taken care of. Contrasted by cyclocross racers who, in my mind, are often creating their own 1-2-3-person teams. So what is your aspiration initially when you graduate from the MS ride to having some talent going off to college? Is it to make a team or is it to create your own team?
Yeah, it's funny you say that because I think initially I didn't, you know, I it's funny to say now that I've been racing for 12 or 13 or however many years that I had a late start to it. But in a lot of ways I did. I didn't really get into it till I was in my early 20s.
Yep.
And I had no, at that point already, all these, the big teams kind of seemed removed. So my aspirations gradually grew as I got better. At first, the aspiration was to like, well, what if I can race local cat 1-2 cross? What if I can do this stuff? Yep. And then like, well, what if I can go and get a UCI point? That would be really cool. And then you get the UCI point. You're like, well, maybe I can win nationals. And it just grew so gradually that I certainly tried to get on teams at different points in time. I think Cannondale, Cyclocross World was the biggest team at the time. And I'm sure I bothered Stu to no end with emails trying to get on that. But like you said, I think there's a certain amount of cross where you just have to be, you just got to figure out on your own. And I realized pretty quickly that the way for me to do that was figure out what I could deliver to the people I was trying to get sponsorship from. Right. I had
good idea.
I was working on my politics degree then and realized like, well, what if I can like send people photos after, just the most basic sponsorship stuff, but it just kind of seemed to work and snowballed from there. So I have to say at this point, still I'm 31. I've never really been on a team where everything's taken care of, but as nice as that would have been, I kind of value the fact that I was never there, right? It was like the school of bike racing, but also the school of how to write professional emails and make CVs and talk to people and present yourself well and all these things that, you know, correlated really well with the fact that I was working on a politics degree, but also added to it. And in some ways got me to where I am now. I don't know if I would have got there had I been on a program where things were taken care of, right?
Yeah. Yeah. And school of hard knocks. How about, so you're a 4-time national champion, 3-time elite, 1-time U23. What, not necessarily walking me through each of those settings, but when you won any one of those, particularly the elite titles, what did your team look like? Like at the highest level or lowest level, were you your full-time logistics officer and full-time mechanic? Or are you showing up with those people at your side? What do those settings look like?
Yeah. Well, so I think for all three of those national titles, I was running a cross program with a couple of my friends, a guy named Dylan Postier and Craig Ritchie. And we were running it as professionally as we could, but also very much on a shoestring budget. Looked good from the outside. We were making things happen from the inside. Okay. So I did have good support. I always had good equipment. We always found budget to hire mechanics and stuff like that for important races. But, you know, I think like a lot of programs, everything looks bright and shiny from the outside, and the inside there's a little bit of chaos going on. But I am really proud of what we put together. Like we, you know, I do feel like I showed up at those nationals that I won having the support I needed, obviously, because it came together. And especially in Canada, just a smaller market than the US, it's sometimes harder for athletes to put those things together. There's less people, less racers, and sort of by extension, less support.
Yeah. I want to talk about a cyclocross race calendar, because in theory, okay, it's stretching a little bit. You can be racing as early as like August or so, and you can race into February. But in theory, it's relatively short. Call it through October through January. Mm-hmm. How many years of your career did you exclusively focus on cyclocross?
I would say I focused on cross from probably almost 7 or 8 years, probably from like 2014 through maybe 10 years, 2014 through 2023 or 2013 through 2023, where that was my primary goal. And I raced domestic level road for a while in there. I did some years where I did a hodgepodge of mountain bike and road. I did some years where I did a bunch of gravel, sort of whatever I felt would best lead into the cross season. But cross had always been the focus up until this season.
And what does the professional side of things look like meaning could you use those other avenues of cycling as a way to leverage income? I mean, were you saying to a frame sponsor, hey, I'm also going to be riding on the road or a mountain bike and I'm a full-time racer?
Yeah, good question. I would say the last couple of years, I was very much leveraging the fact that I was doing a bunch of gravel stuff to race cross. Yep. It was almost like I was, to sponsors, I'd be going, hey, I'm a gravel racer. And then my head would be like, I'm actually 100% all in for cross and I'm going to race just enough gravel to make everybody happy.
Yeah.
And that was, I think people, that's nothing new. Like 10 years ago, 15 years ago, people like Jeremy Powers and Tim Johnson had been doing the same thing with road racing, right?
Yep.
Cross, even in its heyday, was very much a passion-driven sport. The people at the top end, the spectators, the mechanics, the team managers, everyone there just absolutely loves cross and wants it to be successful. But the logistics behind being a cross racer are so much more involved than flying yourself to a gravel race. You need to have some sort of pit set up and multiple bikes and a mechanic. And, you know, the last few years I was racing, I would have like 8 or 9 sets of wheels traveling with me. It's kind of a logistical nightmare. And I, of course, that ends up costing a lot of money.
Uh-huh.
But I still love cross, but I did it because I loved it.
Yeah.
You know, I loved hanging out with everybody before the races, loved the actual racing. Loved how tight the battles are. Or in a lot of ways, it's like we all saw that single track section at Mid-South and we all saw how everyone was queuing up to sprint into it.
Uh-huh.
That was just like a cross race.
Yeah.
Like a cross race is just an hour of battling people into corners.
Yeah.
Because you know there's a pinch point coming up and you know the race is going to be decided coming out of it.
Yeah. Yeah. You hit on so many good things, right? I mean, I'm thinking of when you're talking about Jeremy and Tim and how they're racing on the road as part of the way to continue racing. I mean, because their heart was certainly that of a cross racer as well. So getting to the root of it, what can we talk about the state of North American cyclocross? Like what is the pulse of what's happening in this continent with cyclocross?
Yeah, good question. I think for a couple of years, there may be some cries of is cross dying, and I always pushed against that a little bit. I think it's transitioning from what it was. There was very much the heyday of cross in, when was Louisville Worlds? 2014? Right around yep. Louisville Worlds.
Yep.
When the USGP was really big. But in the East Coast anyways, cross has come back pretty strong, especially with the USCX series being televised on GCN.
Mm-hmm.
Those races have had amazing racing. They feel big. People have been able to watch them. I've always been surprised, like this past year when I'd, you know, come home and do a local race, I was always surprised at how many people came up to me and said, oh, it's been so great to watch you on GCN.
Yeah. That's GCN, awesome.
Rest in peace. I hope those still exist in the
future. Exactly. Hopefully they exist on Max or whatever it is.
But yeah, I don't think it's cross is interesting because in some ways the culture of cyclocross was the current culture of gravel before gravel was really a discipline that people did.
Yeah.
It appealed to a lot of people who just wanted to participate and have fun and hang out with their friends and challenge themselves. And where the downfall of that culture in cross was, is that it's actually, I'm not saying gravel is a very, very hard discipline too, but cross is actually a super hard sport and it's not a lot of fun if you feel like you're just going to get lapped right away. Right.
Mm-hmm.
It's not a lot of fun if you feel like everyone else is showing up with 2 bikes and 8 sets of wheels and you're there on your single speed. And that's where gravel works really well, is there's a spot for the race. And then there's a spot for the 95% of people who either, you know, have some goal, but it's not to win. It's mm-hmm. to have a time goal. It's just to finish. It's to make it to the line, right? So I think cross is now transitioning a little bit where we're in North America, we're really seeing, can it be a sport that people want to watch the pro races when they're televised, when they can be spectators? Because that's always been the model in Europe. right?
Yeah.
But that's never really been the model. So I think we're very much in a spot where we're seeing, like, is that going to work? There's still going to be amateur races, but I've seen that the really local level amateur stuff is not getting the same turnout, even though those USCX races are. So can the sport continue to survive and hopefully eventually thrive if it's a more professional focused sport? Does that get enough eyeballs on it?
Man, oh man. Yeah, the contrast to gravel to cyclocross is spot on. It sort of is a question about the human psyche and our level of competitivity, because the level of competition, as we've alluded to in gravel, has gone sky high in a handful of years. On any given start line, there's only realistically 10 people who could win it in a call it 2,000 person gravel event. And to the credit of cyclocross, you have a variety of different races. So when you line up in a gravel race, yeah, like there is the overall male winner, the overall female winner, a non-binary category. But in cyclocross, yeah, you got different sexes. You have category A, B, C, D, or 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, like whatever the categorization is. And it's almost like one would think that with the different categorizations and everybody inherently trying to be somehow competitive, be it with themselves or the person they're bumping shoulders with, that cyclocross makes even more sense, especially given the distances and times, right? If you're going to race for 45 minutes or an hour max, that makes a heck of a lot more sense than trying to beat yourself up for a 20-hour race once a year. That just seems insane.
I mean, yes and no, but I think the growth of gravel, especially the growth of the 98% of the people who aren't trying to win, speaks to people's desire to accomplish something they don't think or didn't think that they could do. And there is something pretty powerful about that, right?
Yep.
You look at a lot of the people, like I said, and their goal is to finish it. And they might actually be going into that day, even with maybe they can train 4 hours a week, maybe they can train 10 hours a week, maybe they haven't really trained at all.
Mm-hmm.
But I think the goal is like, I don't know if I can do this thing. Let's see if I can do it. And a lot of them do. Like the finish percentage at something like Mid-South is often in the 90%, right?
Yeah,
except
yeah.
for those really heinous, muddy years.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I don't know. There's just something really powerful about that. And that appeals. Everyone knows that they can ride for an hour, right? Whether you're winning or not winning, you know that you're going to make it.
Yeah.
So maybe there's something there in the psyche of people where it's like you want to challenge yourself and do something. You're like, I don't know if this is even possible. And then when you find out that it is, that can be a really powerful thing.
Yeah, that's very well said. And I've rooted for gravel for that reason for a long time, in that I say gravel is the first aspect of cycling, first genre of cycling that is going to bring in the masses, because we thought it was Grand Fondos and that didn't really succeed. I don't think the majority of people see a criterium where people are taking a corner at 25 miles an hour and falling every third turn and say, that's appealing. Road racing isn't it. So yeah, it's the first thing that really draws in the true masses, which is awesome.
And like to that point, I have four siblings and two of my sisters have kind of gotten, well, one especially has kind of gotten into riding her bike and like interested in doing gravel races. And she would never do a crit or a cross race or a mountain bike race. Like that's, you know, she is a cyclist. Obviously she rides her bike, but not in this, not someone you think of who's going to line up and do a crit.
Mm-hmm. Right.
Right. She wants to do a gravel race, wants to ride 100 kilometers or maybe 100 miles at one point in time, but doesn't really care if she gets 50th or 150th or 250th.
Right. I love it. That's awesome. And then talk to me a minute more about what you were talking about with the model, the model that you are seeing in cyclocross North America right now. Were you alluding to eyes on the pro race in person or over GCN? Like, how are races going to succeed?
I thought that having GCN there had the potential to be something really powerful, because it would be great to have a lot of eyes in person. But I think, especially coming out of the pandemic, people value their time a lot, right? They value their Saturday and Sunday afternoons, being able to spend it with family or being able to spend it on their own bike ride or whatever. So having a product that you can watch whenever you want, later on, later in the day, I do think has a lot of value. And one of my concerns this year is like, well, if it's not on GCN, are these races going to be somewhere? Because if they are, I will continue to watch them.
Sure.
If they aren't, hopefully I'll be able to go to a handful of races, but I'm certainly not traveling to all these USCX events and standing around the course and watching the race happen.
Yeah.
Right. If they exist, I'm going to watch them maybe live, maybe that evening, maybe when I'm riding the trainer, like who knows, it's going to happen though. And I think there's a lot of people who are kind of in that similar boat.
Yeah. It's interesting with a television audience, because that's going to dwarf whatever is going to be the audience live and in person. And so, yeah, what's fun about a cyclocross weekend is there are races all throughout the day. And then so long as you can sacrifice the final hour of the day, you mm-hmm. stick around for the pro race.
But that's a max, what there may be 600 people racing a day?
Right.
So it's capped. 600 people plus some family plus... maybe you manage to draw in some local cycling community that's uh-huh. invested, but it's not going to be, you're not going to have a ginormous crowd watching the races.
Right.
They get that in Belgium, but just the whole structure, it's, you know, it's Sunday night or Sunday afternoon football. It's different.
Right.
And we've talked about whether that'll happen in North America for a long time. And to this point, it just hasn't.
Sure.
I don't know if it ever will.
Is there, I mean, my question wants to be is, how do we revitalize North American cyclocross? And maybe it is with this model, maybe it's more with more television. For me, it's the television. I mean, mm-hmm. the way you and I were talking before the show, today was Doors Door of Vlaanderen. Go USA. We had an American winner, which was really cool, and Matteo Jorgensen.
Very cool. The most exciting, we talked about this, the most exciting, most disappointing Doors Door of Vlaanderen, yeah. Because
exactly.
One of the favorites, maybe two, I haven't heard anything about Mads Pedersen, is out. And I want Flanders to be awesome.
Exactly. Yeah, biggest one-day race. I don't think our North American audience realizes just how big Tour of Flanders is. That is that's the Super Bowl in a single day.
I prefer it to Paris-Roubaix. I think it's, I don't know. I just think the way the course is means that someone like Pogacar can win and someone like Alaphilippe can win and someone like, well, not Wout anymore, but Wout or Mads Pedersen or, you know, all these different types of riders have the capabilities of being successful there.
Totally. So with the point being, watching bike racing is something that there is a demand there. So it's a shame that GCN has lost its footing. Conveniently, Max and Flow Bikes and Peacock, these other networks exist. Can you see a way to revitalize it? I mean, it's the same way if someone were to pose the question to me, how does road racing come back in North America? I don't have an answer outside of millions of dollars being poured into races like Tour California.
Yeah, I guess it's twofold there. I think the financial support for cross racers has dwindled a little bit as well. And that's going to make it really challenging when you have a lot of your best, you know, it's like, who are the best cross racers in North America right now? Well, there's a good list of them, like Tobin Ortenblad and Kerry Werner, who didn't really race much cross last year because they were both in Lifetime. And while we know that season goes to October, it's pretty challenging to do both.
Mm-hmm.
And then there's a lot of people, myself, I think you can put Curtis in this category, who were racing cross, but it was really a passion project because we loved the sport, not because it was a huge money-making opportunity.
Mm-hmm.
So there's two things. It's like, what comes first? Do you get the best riders first, or do you get the television and get some more money in the sport and that keeps the best riders in? I don't know.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's a great question on passion project. Which then is speaking to this next phase of what you're stepping into. And I'm thinking of the passion piece being like, do you focus purely on the racing or do you garner millions of dollars of television sponsorship and work a behind the desk job. So you have stepped in as the national team coach for Canada Cyclocross. Is that correct?
Yeah, that's right. So I did my first two projects with them this winter. I basically stopped racing in November and then was in Europe in December with the national team. And then again in January for Worlds.
That is awesome.
It was really cool.
Congratulations.
I was a little, I mean, it was a pretty quick transition and I had actually had a pretty good cross season, but last year, so January, 2023, like a full season ago, I did go to Europe and I just sort of had this feeling of, it's not that I was racing poorly. It's just that I felt like I knew what I was in Europe. Uh-huh. And the desire, I guess, to get another, at my best, I was a, I don't know, I had a handful of top 20s at World Cups. Usually I was like a top 30, top 40 World Cup guy. Uh-huh. And I just sort of felt like, you know, I've done this. I don't think I need to keep doing it. It's a lot of, not just a lot of work, but can I help? There's got to be better. There's better people in Canada who are coming up. Like, can I make their path a little bit easier? Can I be involved in their development? Because I've gotten this far and this is probably what I am at this point. I'm not going to pop out next week and get a top 10 in a World Cup. Like, it wasn't in the cards for me.
That it's a neat perspective. And you've certainly cut your teeth to have that wealth of knowledge that you can pass on in the first place. So yeah, what is, when you take over that role, when you go into these projects and going forward, what does your job look like?
Yeah, it's funny because, you know, the official job title is coach, but with a lot of these roles on the national team level, it's like 80% logistics, chaperoning, driving people to the right places.
Yeah.
10% solving problems for juniors and 10% coaching.
You're like, you got the wrong socks and we need to get a new hotel.
We had a junior who forgot his asthma. You know, he has asthma and he forgot his puffer in Canada and we're in the Czech Republic and you're figuring out, you're like, okay, how do we get the prescription? How do we do this in a healthcare system we don't know and don't understand with doctors? Like, and we got it sorted out, but it was infinitely harder than it would be in Canada.
Yeah. Not to mention like entering a TUE and cross language barriers and.
Exactly.
That's so wild.
I actually really enjoy that part. Making sure that people get to where they need to go and lining up. Like the job typically looks like, so yes, I'm the coach, but I'm also figuring out when are all the vehicles leaving to get to the race?
Yep.
Who's, what mechanics are doing what race? When are we getting the riders there? Who's with our riders? We often do like communal dinners. Who's cooking dinner tonight?
Yeah.
All these little things that come together. And then you sprinkle in some like riding the course with everybody and talking about race tactics. But the reality is by the time these athletes have showed up at something like Worlds, they have their coaches. You're not going to go and change their process 4 days before a major event. Right. You just want to be there to help make it as seamless as possible.
Sure. Who, presumably somebody was in this role before you, with the question being, you know, you stepped in December. What was that role before?
Yeah. So Rob Holmgren, which would be the father of Ava and Isabella Holmgren and Gunnar. I shouldn't leave him out. He's a very good cyclist as well. So he was in the role before. And I think he was running their team as well. And they've obviously moved on to Lidl Trek. So he kind of stepped aside and that opened up the spot. And that was actually one of the driving reasons behind why I decided there's a number of reasons why I decided that this would be my last cross season. Uh-huh. But one of them was, this was a job I was very interested in. I wanted to do it. I felt like I could provide something for Canadian athletes and it was available. Mm-hmm. If I didn't take it this year and didn't apply and didn't try to take that role, when was it going to be available again? Right. There's only one cyclocross national team position. Uh-huh. So the kind of the opportunity was there and I felt like, you know, now is the time. Why not?
Yeah. That's awesome. How much does, so obviously the job, when the fall rolls around, you're going to be doing that job very full-time. What does it look like for the other, call it, 6 months of the year?
Yeah, it's definitely seasonal. It's primarily running those two projects and then being involved with things like writing the selection criteria, which, oh boy, that's maybe the
toughest.
Yeah, that's one of the toughest parts of the job. Writing selection criteria, figuring out what can we do for projects. Of course, there's finite budget with all of these things, especially with a national sporting organization. Like, uh-huh. What's the best use of our funds? How can we get athletes to as many races? What races are they going to be able to get themselves to?
Yeah.
But it's primarily a job to run those European projects and figuring out, you know, how can we support our Canadian athletes earlier in the season to make sure that they show up to Europe. This year we had like 8 athletes who had never been to Europe before. So how can we make sure that they show up there as prepared as possible? There's nothing that's really going to prepare you for racing in Europe, yeah. But you can be more prepared or you can be less prepared. And how can we have them be more prepared?
And does any aspect of the job, to go back to the passion project GCN thing, does any aspect of the job involve fundraising?
It does not. I am kind of thankful about that, actually. That's fundraising. I have a ton of respect for people that do it. I feel like there's a certain amount of, as someone who's sort of running your own program, it's not fundraising per se, but you're talking to a lot of different partners about money and, it's not my favorite part of the equation.
No, that it is a skill, and it's a skill that certain people possess and other people love.
Some people are really good at it.
I hear you.
And I'm not one of them.
And switching gears almost entirely, talk to me about the 2023 season. Just this past fall, you did something really cool with your family. Meaning, you got a motorhome trailer type thing. I guess those are two different things. You got a tow-along trailer, and you brought your wife and, I want to say at that point, 6, 7, 8-month-old son along.
Yeah, he was born in March, so it would have been 6 months at the start of cross season. Yeah, it was maybe the best worst idea we've ever had. You have kids, you know how like I live in Chilliwack, BC, so basically about as far west as you can get. Sure. And most of the cross season is on the very east coast.
Mm-hmm.
So we drove across the country with our little 6-month-old,
mm-hmm.
Pulling the trailer and went to all these races. And kind of the reason behind that is my wife she's a teacher. So she has been working during my cross season for basically the entire thing.
Yeah.
We traveled to Europe together in 2014, and she came to a lot of the racing. But basically since then, you know, fall rolls around, Kira goes to work, I go to race cross races.
Uh-huh.
Obviously, we talk about and everything, but it was very much like I'd be doing my thing at the cross races and she'd be teaching.
Yeah.
And this was a really, if it was going to be my last season, she wanted to be able to be a part of it.
Yeah.
Again, and we also had this opportunity, like, it, you know, in Canada, our mat leave is a year long. So wow. She was on maternity leave.
Nice.
And we had this opportunity that we might never have again.
Mm-hmm.
Right. It's going to be increasing. If we have another kid, it's going to be increasingly difficult to do this with two children. I'm getting older. I wasn't going to keep racing forever.
Yeah.
So it's kind of one of those things. It's like, yeah, you can think of all the reasons why you shouldn't do something. Having a kid, it's going to be too difficult. They're going to cry the whole time, whatever. But one of the pieces of advice I got from my brother and sister-in-law, actually, is they were like, just keep living your life. Like, you have to still do stuff. You just have the child be a part of it, yeah. Right? Yeah. Have them involved. It's going to be terrible sometimes. It's going to be awesome sometimes. And you just got to, like, roll with the punches. Mm-hmm. So that's kind of what we did. And you know what? By and large, it was pretty awesome to have them a part of that. It was, like, one of those experiences that was... Obviously, Rowan's not going to remember it. He was a year old, but I will remember it. Kira's going to remember it. It was like a really special time that we were just able to spend as a family.
Yeah. That's so cool. So you were all three of you on the East Coast for that entire period, for the whole season?
We were there from Roanoke, which was the first race, middle of September, for about Actually, before that, we went to Rebecca's Private Idaho. Uh-huh. So first week of September. Uh-huh. And then we stayed. We weren't back home until the end of October. Wow. So I did do one more race weekend on the East Coast that I just flew to.
Yeah.
But we were, I think, 8 weeks. We were away from home, kind of living in the trailer.
That's amazing. As someone who puts our family of four in a van and have driven across the country a couple of times, yeah, I know that there are challenges. I know that it can put a dent in your training, to put it peacefully. But it's the kind of experience that I wouldn't trade for anything. And it's incredible.
Yeah, it really is. And like I said, I think we're both parents. It's like something something I just believe is like, yeah, you just gotta do stuff with your kid. Like, just make them a part of it.
100%.
Don't be afraid of what could go wrong, because something's going to go wrong. It'll be fine.
Yeah. Well, yeah, I think Laura especially had a lot of friends who were like, oh, kiss your former life goodbye, kiss training goodbye, kiss bike riding goodbye. And seemingly it was from folks who parent, not to say first and foremost, because we are parents first and foremost, but like with the expectation that it's just going to ruin your life. And exactly what you said, what your brother and sister-in-law said, it's like, make your kids part of your life as opposed to revolving your life around theirs. It's sort of like this symbiotic spinning orbits, which works mm-hmm. really well together.
I mean, yeah, it's like, don't get me wrong. You can't, my life is definitely not the same as it was before we had a kid.
Right.
But it's just different. It's not like it's way better in a lot of ways.
Yeah.
You just be a little bit more on top of scheduling and stuff like that, but you can still do what you need to do.
Yeah. It involves more coffee and then you just get it done. Well, that's awesome.
Absolutely.
Do you guys own the trailer? Did you buy it? Did you rent it? How'd that work out?
No, we actually borrowed it from we talked about buying one, but my parents had this nice trailer that they weren't going to use all fall. So we drove to their place in Manitoba and picked it up and then continued on the way. It was a great opportunity. Like, you know, they live pretty far from there. They have a bunch of grandchildren, but he's the youngest one. So it was a good opportunity to stop by and spend some quality, you know, grandma, grandpa, grandson time. He got to sit in the combine with my dad, which was pretty special.
That's awesome. That's special. I love it. Well, I will wrap with three questions. Very hard hitting, very thought provoking. What is your favorite place to ride a bike? What is the number one place that you would like to ride a bike that you've never been? And with whom would you like to go for a bike ride?
Ooh, okay. Favorite place to ride a bike? I think it's here, like where I live. And yeah, you ride your same training. I live in a place called Chilliwack River Valley. Uh-huh. It's like, yeah, everything gets old when you ride it enough. But every single day, I feel like I'm out riding at home. There's something. I look into the mountains or look at how the clouds are forming. Even today when it was just like pissing rain all day.
Yeah.
I kind of catch myself and go, this is pretty incredible. It's beautiful. I love it here.
That's awesome.
Where I want to ride a bike. Good question. Because I was a cross racer, I spent lots of time in Europe, but almost entirely riding in Belgium in winter.
Yep.
So I have never ridden my bike in Italy. I've never ridden any of the big French climbs. I have had the chance to go to Spain for training camps, but I think I'd love to ride in Italy. And I'm not even super picky on where. I've mostly been in Belgium in the winter. It'd be nice to branch out a little bit next time I go to Europe.
Yeah. Well, you know what's funny on that, to interject? We were watching these spring classics, Tour of Flanders, so on and so forth. And I raced all of these races, and it was nice being there in Easter and things are blooming. But there was still sort of like this ominous sense of doom and gloom because racing was so foolishly hard. Even though I was racing with Sagan and we often won these races, which was really neat. But the point is, like, through the benefit of time, I watch these races now and I think it is so beautiful. This country of Belgium, you know, they have the aerial views It's like, it's bucolic and old and historic and really, really cool. So I don't know what it's like in winter, but being that I live in New England and there's a lot of weather similarities between New England and Belgium, I can see why being there in the winter wouldn't be the most inspiring. Being there in the spring is pretty neat. That all being said, riding in Italy is much better than both winter or spring in Belgium. So yeah, definitely go to Italy.
So what, maybe I'll ask you. So I've ridden in like Kelpie, Benidorm area.
Uh-huh.
What part of Italy is like, what's, I know people ride in Kelpie because it's nice and uh-huh. the weather's nice, but also dirt cheap,
yeah.
right?
Yeah.
Like you can get your Airbnb for like $500 for 2 weeks. It's crazy cheap there. Where should I want to go in Italy? What was your favorite spot?
Two spots. Tuscany, basically all of Tuscany is amazing. I lived in Lucca, which is west, sort of west central, and Florence area is really nice. If you go down to Siena and that area, it's like every time you go over a hill, it's like being in a postcard. So that was amazing. And so basically there or way go way north and ride in the Dolomites. There's something about the Dolomites that are just, there are these pillars of mountains, which sounds weird and almost sounds like a cartoonish that a mountain could just be so vertical as opposed to being mountainous. The Dolomites are out of this world.
Huh. So that actually reminds me, you know, the top, I could have put this as one of my favorite places to ride, but I've only been there a couple times. Top sneaky, great riding spot in North America, the Black Hills in South Dakota.
Yeah.
It's wild.
Yes.
Like you're driving, then you're like, where am I going to ride my bike here? Uh-huh. It's all prairies. And all of a sudden it's just mountains. And there's these mountains called the Fingers that just like pillars of mountain, yeah. exactly as you describe.
Yeah.
Just incredible.
Now, yeah, the Dakotas, both North and South Dakota are surprising in some of their topography. And yeah, the Black Hills are amazing.
Yeah. It's not just Mount Rushmore and the giant dead president heads. There's lots else there.
Ah, beautiful. Well, with whom, to wrap up, with whom would you like to go for a bike ride? Sort of the, if you could dine with anybody one particular time, who would it be?
Good question. I suppose there's no easy answer here. Is it just a cyclist? Do I choose like the, like Robin Williams before he passed? He'd be pretty fun to ride a bike with.
It's a great answer. If I do the long-winded way of asking this question, I say fictitious or non, living or otherwise.
Yeah, it'd be, I mean, I'd love to ride with some of the greats of cycling, mm-hmm. but I think you'd have a more interesting, wide-reaching, hilarious conversation with someone like Robin Williams.
Yeah, well, he's a cyclist, so it's perfect. We'll put him on the top of the list. And instead of just saying goodbye, I meant to ask this question earlier, which also dovetails off, okay, here's the cyclocross coaching aspect of your calendar, and going back full circle to, hey, I just saw you 2 weeks ago at Mid-South. I think you're doing a handful of events this year. How do you pick your calendar, and what events do you have on your calendar this year?
Yeah, okay. So how do I pick my calendar? Because this is kind of a funny one for, I think, the people doing the Lifetime Grand Prix. It's very cut and dried. You do the Lifetime Grand Prix events.
Mm-hmm.
I got to choose my calendar, and it was very much a combination of when things were, places that I wanted to visit.
Mm-hmm.
That's actually a driving force behind a lot of my calendar. Like I'm doing the FOCO Gran Fondo in Fort Collins, and part of the impetus there was I haven't been to Fort Collins. I'd love to go.
Good reason.
Which is kind of a funny reason. But that's one of the things that excites me about riding in general, but racing gravel is like I'm driven by seeing new places, and you know, why not make your schedule work for that?
Heck yeah.
That's perfect. And then also, I like a handful of events in here that, like Mid-South, like Sea Otter, a few others later in the calendar. I think there's a little bit of ego attached, but I'd like to see how I stack up against the best of the best when it comes to gravel racing in North America. Because a lot of times those people are doing the Lifetime events. So mm-hmm. there's a handful of races where I'm like, you know, I want to see how it goes. I'm doing my separate calendar and I love that. But like, let's go kick some butt
yeah.
somewhere else.
I love it. So yeah. What events do you have this year outside of FOCO yeah. and Mid-South?
So yeah, so Sea Otter's next up, and then I'm going
to... And sorry, which event are you racing at Sea Otter?
Both. Both mountain and gravel.
Nice.
The back-to-back. So the mountain bike is for ego, because I want to see how I do against the lifetime people.
Yep.
The gravel race, I am kind of handicapping myself, I guess, because I'm racing the mountain bike race first, but I'd like to win.
Mm-hmm. Good answer. Here's... food for thought. I think you'll win the gravel race on a mountain bike.
But I think it's different this year.
Oh, go on.
Yeah, I think they changed it because too many people said this is a mountain bike race. And they were kind of right. It was the same course.
It was literally the same course, minus one lap.
So previously, I tried the other approach a couple of years ago. I was in your group, actually. I tried to race the mountain bike race on a gravel bike, which in theory was a good idea, but there were so many braking bumps, it was a bad idea.
Yeah. That's why I was thinking you were in the Grand Prix. And I don't even... I guess I was in the Grand Prix that year. But yeah, we were in the same group, and I was like...
You were fully, like, your elbow had recently been reattached to itself.
Yeah, yeah. That was the first event back. That was less opportunity.
And I think you crashed, and we were like, oh no, Ted's dead now. But you weren't. You came back.
He survived. Okay, so you got your ego to test and your legs to test.
Then I'm going to Paris Doncaster, which is a race that you've done, which is essentially a 3-hour cross race. I think we can probably
that
agree on that one.
Is fantastic. That's one of these underground races that doesn't get nearly as much hype as it deserves, yet is kind of event that I think wants to live under the radar. Paris Doncaster is an amazing event in Canada.
It's one of my, just the way the tactics play out in it.
Yeah.
How hard it is in certain sections. You can speak to this obviously a lot better than I, cause I've never raced a classic, but it feels like the way you queue up for the sections and try to get into the sectors is like a version of what it must feel like to try to be queue up for some of these classic sections.
Yeah. Well, yeah, no different than when you were talking about Mid-South, how it's like, I mean, that was a funny lead into the single track in Mid-South. It shocked me how long it took the group to put in that final dig. And the same thing at Paris Doncaster. It's like slow, 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 sprint to the sector, get through the sector, having shelled a few people, and then you come out slow and attack the next one. Yeah, it definitely, to your point, the tactics of that are totally different than any other gravel race.
It's just fun. Yep. And then the sections are so decisive and so hard.
Yep.
A little bit of road furniture thrown in for good measure. And it, you know, in this case, the road furniture is pillars in the middle of the bike path, but you know,
you just gotta be aware. Okay. So that takes us to what? Early April, mid April.
Yeah. May I'm basically sticking around home, doing some local stuff. June, I'll be doing Canadian Gravel Nationals. I'm doing a mountain bike race before that. Whistler Back 40, Canadian Gravel Nationals, Oregon Trails.
Nice.
Yeah, I'm excited about that one, especially with, I won it last year, but this year it's a part of the, what's it called? Gravel Earth Series.
Oh, no way. Huh.
Yeah, and I think it's going to be hard.
Like, do you think, does that mean it draws in some more international talent?
Well, it sounds like Pete Stetna and Rob Britton are both going to be there. So that's enough to already make it hard.
Yep.
We'll see how many more people come.
Yeah. Interesting. Yeah. That's a whole podcast unto itself, is the amalgamation, the creation of series in gravel, good or bad, discuss.
Yeah, we could. I agree. The Gravel Earth one's interesting because, you know, Lifetime has a wide variety of stuff. Gravel Earth has like a wide, wide, wide variety of lengths and types of races and everything.
Huh. Interesting. Well, yeah, the Lifetime Grand Prix is interesting in that it is a collection of the events that Lifetime owns. And so as much as Schwamigan is different than Unbound, yes, they are very different types of races. By and large, they are a gravel series with a mountain bike presence. Anyway, anyway.
Unless you speak to the mountain bikers, then they'd be like, hey guys, these are not mountain bike races.
Yeah. Okay. So good calendar so far. I like it. And I'm not trying to put you on the spot to make you remember your full calendar.
No. I was just looking at it because I thought this would maybe be involved. So this is a good skill memory testing question. Where are we? Boco Fondo. I'm doing Trans Rockies Gravel Royale. I'm doing Rebecca's Private Idaho again.
Nice.
I like the stage races. I really like gravel stage races.
RPI is amazing. I did the first ever stage race. Jeez. Let me date myself. That was like 2017, I think. Maybe 2018. RPI is such a fun event. So I'm glad you're a return participant. We've been back at least one other time. That's an awesome one.
I mean, obviously I knew Idaho was beautiful, but it's one of those places that I had not been. And I went there and I was like, oh my goodness, it's stunning out here.
Yeah.
Like I need to come back.
Yeah.
This is awesome.
Yep.
Plus, yeah. There was a parade with camels and like a 28-car wagon.
Dude, that was the sweetest part. We didn't have any idea we were going to be in it, but I did it as part of World Bicycle Relief. And they're like, oh, you guys are part of the parade. And so I got to be in the parade. It was amazing. So unfortunately, cool. I missed the camels. But yeah, I knew that there was something fun going on.
I'll give that race a shout out. If you have a family and you want a race to go to, RPI is the one of the best ones. Because you stay in Ketchum, which is a nice town. Mm-hmm. You don't race on Saturday. Mm-hmm. There's lots of family stuff to do. Like, it's a good mix between family vacation and bike race.
Yeah.
If you're into that.
100%. Amazing destination. Labor Day weekend. Bring the fam. Have a blast.
Yeah.
It's a good one.
And then after that, I maybe will do Big Sugar. I'm not quite used to this register 10 months before the race thing happens.
Kind of so
I gotta scratch and claw my way into that one still, beg my way into it.
Yeah. Yeah.
Maybe Little Sugar as well. Belgian Waffle Ride Canada is in there.
Uh-huh.
And then we'll see if I've run out of gas or how busy I am with doing cross stuff. If I do Iceman Comet, this one I've always wanted to do.
Yep.
But, you know, it's getting pretty late and I'll be picking up the other job by then.
Yeah, it's interesting in March when you start seeing flowers come up out of the ground and aspirations are high as compared to when even September rolls around. You're like, oh, man, I've been doing this for a long time. I kind of want a break. So I hear you. I hear you.
Yeah. It'll be good. It's like it's actually less racing. I mean, especially when you cut out the cross season, it's a lot less racing than I've done in the past, but I think just the balance of being able to spend that much more time at home is to me is just becoming increasingly valuable, right? Days away from home seem like more, I love them. I like traveling places, but it also seems like more of a, feels like you're missing out now. With big the time.
I hear you. Yeah. Well, I'm excited because that means I'll see you in just a couple of weeks at Sea Otter.
Perfect. What are you doing?
I'll be doing the mountain bike race. I have no aspirations of, I mean, I was saying earlier to somebody that if I finish top 25, I'm happy because it's such a, that's a really hard mountain bike race. I do it for the scene to be there. I want to do an event. I didn't realize that the gravel event had changed.
Don't come into my gravel event. I'm going to win that one, Ted. Stay away.
No. This is a logistical nightmare. I got to get 5 bikes to California between me and Laura.
Oh my goodness.
Basically just a heck of a lot going on, but I will probably not be doing the gravel event. And so I look forward to doing that bike race and Seattle is such a big show that it's not to be missed. So
in a couple weeks. It's nice. Like we kind of make fun of Seattle, but it is so valuable to be able to physically talk to 90% of the people who support you in one afternoon. Mm-hmm. You can't do that anywhere else.
Well, geez. Oh, right. Support you, meaning the sponsors. That's what I was going to say, to go full circle on the television impact of bike races. It's an interesting thing. Sea Otter, that's a consumer-facing event, right? So anybody can show up, and that's cool. And you feel like, as a brand, if you aren't there, then you're missing out. Even though the percentage of people who are cyclists in North America who show up as compared to the entire demographic of cyclists in North America is such a drop in the bucket. So it's so funny that every brand feels like they need to be there.
It's actually very Yes. And to continue that thought in some ways, very counter to what we were talking about with cyclocross, is gravel racing isn't really televisable. I mean, maybe it is, but to this point, it hasn't been. I think there were some efforts a couple of years ago. Mm-hmm. But yet the events are big enough that that almost doesn't matter. And there's enough, you know, enough YouTube series, Instagram clips, reels coming out of it that it seems like, yeah, it seems like it just doesn't matter.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And yeah. We'll see. Is that like sustainable in the long run or not? I think Enduro is running into a similar type thing where Enduro is essentially the, you know, it's the gravel equivalent of mountain biking in a lot of ways. Uh-huh. Big interest from the general public, professional scene. Really, really hard to watch if you want to watch a live stream.
Yeah. Valid. Very valid. Yeah, we could. That's a whole nother podcast. So I'll save you from having to talk about that for another hour. So I will let you go. Michael, this has been amazing. I appreciate the time. I'll see you in a few weeks. And congratulations on all of the things happening, because it's all very fun.
Yeah, thanks very much for having me, Ted. I'll try to win something like Dwarsdorf Landerin, like your previous podcast guest.
That'd be great.
No promises.